Welcome, new listeners, to I Seem Fun, the Diary of Jen Kirkman podcast. I have been doing this podcast since April of 2013, and I have always been a podcast fanatic. I love listening to podcasts. I love hearing people talk about their lives. And the reason I started this podcast was at the time I was on a TV show called Chelsea Lately, where I was appearing nightly making jokes about celebrities. And then people could also see me on Drunk History, where I was getting wasted talking about history. And nobody really seemed to know who I was. Did they think people thought I was drunk like that all the time? Or they thought, oh, Jen only cares about Lindsay Lohan. And I felt like, you know what? I really want people to know who I am. And unfortunately, when I was on the road a lot, people would be at my shows screaming out, let's get drunk or whatever. And I thought, oh, they don't really know me. I'm not that fun. And so as a joke, I said, I'm going to do a podcast called I Seem Fun, meaning, but I'm not. And then I called it the Diary of Jen Kirkman podcast because it was supposed to be a once a week, and it still is, solo podcast where I talk about what went on with me during the week, whether it's serious or silly, you know, kind of curmudgeon-y complaining, whether it's something going on in the world, something political. I've cried on this podcast. I've taken you guys deep into my life, breakups and get back togethers and family stuff. It's just like your friend talking to you who's rude and doesn't let you get a word in edgewise. And it's off the top of my head every week. I prepare briefly the topics I want to talk about, but that's it. It's just a fun free-for-all where you can just see the real me. And I hope you enjoy it. You can subscribe on iTunes. You can listen on Google Play. You can listen on Stitcher. You can listen on SoundCloud. And I'll give you a review from the Onion AV Club. What makes I Seem Fun, the Diary of Jen Kirkman. See, I can't even advertise my own fucking show. What makes I Seem Fun, the Diary of Jen Kirkman podcast funny is Kirkman's inherent knack for cultivating conflict, even talking into a microphone in a room by herself. Whether she's dissecting a negative iTunes review from an angry Christian or seriously considering a class action lawsuit against Robin Thicke for being gross, Kirkman is eternally embattled, but she tempers her cynicism with sweetness, and more often than not, she's right. That is from the Onion AV Club. So if you're curious, well, I guess you can start with this episode and go through the backlog. If you want to stay, here comes the podcast. You're about to get on the ride. I see fun. I see fun. The Diary of Jen Kirkman podcast. I Seem Fun, the Diary of Jen Kirkman podcast. I think this is episode 242. I didn't look. I'm not looking at my notes yet. I just was like, oh, shit. I only have this much time to record. I got to start. Whew, let's start. I know. Why do I every time? You know what it is? I'm leaving for New York in like 15 hours. I have to get up at 3 a.m. to get to my flight. And that's not your. I'm a blaming you. It's a little bit your fault, but, you know, mostly mine. But hey, when you want to get those sweet JetBlue mint, sweet, literally S-U-I-T-E seats, where it's the first class, but it's like even better because you're in your own little compartment. God, I was trying to explain it to my mother. Did they have showers in it? I'm like, no, not flying to Saudi Arabia. It's just, it's like you're in a first class seat, but it's like a little pod and you don't have someone right next to you. I would get claustrophobic. No, it's bigger than if someone's next to you. Like you can get up, you can go, there's a door. I wouldn't want that. Well, you can keep the door open. So is it like, but there's no bed. I go, no, there's a lay down bed. It's like, it's the best. Oh, can people see you? Yeah. It's not like an actual apartment. Forget it. Forget it. But yes, I fly so goddamn much. Got all my points. I am nailing it with always getting to get in the. I booked my tickets so early. I always get the little compartment. And, but then, you know, certain flights are cheaper than others. So you get on that 545, bitch. Anyway, so I'm going to be in New York for the summer. I'm continuing my job as a writer on The Marvelous Miss Maisel. God damn it, these headphones are all jacked up. I know I have the new listener intro at the beginning of every episode. If you're a new listener and you still are thrown by, this is how it starts? Yes, this is what it's like. Well, just do some quick business up front. Not too much, but on sale right now, August 20th, Monday night, 7 o'clock doors, 7:30 show, 1 hour of me. I'm going to be doing... Now, if you've seen me around New York in the past couple of years, you might have seen some of this stuff before. I'm putting it all together in a different way, in a different order, trying to make a little comprehensive show with a theme. And you can come see it. I've got some special people coming to view the material to see if they would want to do something with it. So I could use all the support I can get. And I'm at Union Hall. It's only 100 seats. If you missed out on the chance to see me on July 22nd and 29th, because those are both sold out in advance, then come to August 20th. Now, I do also know that, not to add more confusion, but with Union Hall, they usually release... Like, I think they don't put all the tickets available on sale in advance. I think they hold, like, 10 aside for walk-up that night. So if you want the days of any of those shows, July 22nd, July 29th, August 20th, try your hand. How does that sound? And then, of course, I'm going to be at the Vermont Comedy Club in Burlington, Vermont, October, for 5 shows, 3 nights, 5 shows. That is going to be October 11th, 12th, and 13th. So those tickets are already on sale. That's a very small venue. It's 160 seats. So get the tickets now. Everything is on jenkirkman.com. Click tour dates. Again, I'm still working out the rest of my year. I have another script to write for something else. And I don't know. I don't think I'll be touring too much this year. And we're kind of trying to figure it out. So join that email list. Because I send out an email once a week. It's usually twice a month, to be honest, TBH. And you'll find out where I'm coming and when. But right now, I can't make any plans. This episode is brought to you by Suave, Talkspace, and Quip. We will get into all of our fine sponsors later at I Seem Fun Podcast on Twitter, facebook.com/I Seem Fun Podcast, and go to my website, jenkirkman.com. You can click on the podcast button and get all the episodes. You can hear us on Spotify, Google Play, SoundCloud, Libsyn, iTunes, of course, is my favorite. If you subscribe on iTunes, that helps, I don't know, make me a better person. And all the back episodes exist, I hear, on SoundCloud. All righty. So how is everyone's Foth? I spent my 4th of July in Russia, like many of the GOP senators. Oh, I'm just kidding. And I ain't shitting on the GOP, just this weird GOP that's all Russia'd up, and some of the left that is too, and that will come out. And again, we don't need to get into it right here. Oh my God, I watched I love any World War II movie. I'm all over. Like, I don't like movies about murder and death and TV shows about that stuff, and I don't like anything about that, but like I can watch war stuff and I usually look away if it's too gory or whatever, but I don't know what it is. Like if it's a war, it's okay. If it's like The Godfather and it's just people and their little mobbed up things shooting each other, it makes me very anxious. But there's something about the look, we all knew what we were getting into here of a war movie where I can relax into it, but I hate just like random people like Son of Sam, like everyone getting murdered. Like it freaks me out. But a war, I feel like that's over there. And I don't go to bed at night going, what if a war breaks out in my living room? But if I listen to or watch something about a ghost story or some murderous man that's running around or woman or alien, you know, I lay in bed all night worrying about it. So, but war movies, I love. I get all inspired. And so I watched one I'd never seen. I highly recommend, it has that kind of, now I've never seen 127 Hours, but it has that kind of bent where it's a little bit like I'm in the woods, I've got gangrene, maybe I'm cutting my toe off, you know, I'm bleeding, I'm running, but with the excitement of being literally chased by a Nazi who's like obsessed with finding out if you're dead or alive because he has to report back to Hitler. And this is all a true story. How about you tell us the name of the movie, Jen, or you just keep describing? It's called The 12th Man. It is a, I think it's a Norwegian film. Do you know what? And there are subtitles, like they speak a little English in it too, but it's one of those movies where even when they're speaking English, it's like people are mumbling and there's an accent and they're talking quietly. So I put the subtitles on like my television. So I didn't even use the film's subtitles because there's a lot of snow in this movie. And I read reviews that said the subtitles are in white and they're over the snow. So it's sometimes hard to read. So if you have a TV that you can put subtitles on, like, do it. But I didn't even notice, like, usually I was like, I'm not in the mood to read. I just want to relax and watch a World War II movie without having to read. You know what I mean, girls? So, but I didn't even realize I was. Like, it was that good a movie where this dumb brain didn't even realize it was reading. The acting is amazing. But it's a true story, and I'm sure little flavors here and there were added for story. But the amazing true events that happened, your brain can't comprehend. There's no spiritual or scientific explanation to how this man survived. And that's not a spoiler. The movie's called The 12th Man. And they say up front, 12 men went to do this mission. Only one came back. So it's thrilling. And halfway through, what I realized about it was it's not about that this guy's going to save World War II and he's going to take down Hitler if he only survives. You know, it's like, no, once he survives, he goes to Sweden and he just starts his life over, you know, because that was neutral territory. But it was more about his very survival was giving the people of Norway hope when they were invaded, when they were occupied by the Nazis. And I think it was 63 different people, all different villagers helped him. You know, here's some soup, here's some supplies. You can stay with us for the night. We'll hide you over here. Because the Nazi said, if any of you hide this guy, you will be killed instantly. So, and it was about the people, like what are you made of in that moment? Like, will you help someone? You know, so I loved it. And of course, it took me, this is a movie I don't watch with anyone else. This is a movie, this is some Jen time. It took about 4.5 hours to watch because I have to pause. I have to look it up and go, did this happen? And I'm doing research and I'm reading articles. And that's how I like to watch historical movies. Documentaries, I don't have to do it as much because they're kind of laying it out there for you. But filmed acting movies, what do you call those? Movies, but there's a word for it. Docudrama? I have to keep looking it up. That's why I hated that fucking Apple movie so much. I know there's been like 20 of them. It's like saying, you know that mass shooting? No, which one? The 14,000th one. The Apple movie, it was like the Steve Jobs one. I was Googling as I was watching, and they were like, none of that happened. They're like, he didn't even own a black turtleneck. That's all fake. I mean, that's not true. That was like the only true thing. It's like he had a black turtleneck. I'm like, why'd you even make this movie then? Why don't you just, I'm sure, ugh. Don't get me started. Look, I can deal with fiction if it's 100% fiction. But if you're going to be like, here's a movie about Steve Jobs, most of it's not true. Why am I watching it? Why I'm wasting my time with that shit? So anyway, I enjoyed the movie. Highly recommend. It's called The 12th Man. Somebody told me it was on Netflix. I couldn't find it on Netflix, just like I'm hearing a lot of people can't find my fucking second special, Just Keep Living. Just keep watching it. Just Keep Living is my second special. It's my favorite one, and I highly recommend you watch it all the way through. Even if you're not in the room, just let it play and give it a thumbs up, or whatever they do now, hearts, thumbs up. Eventually, just because everything is so awful, like, comments will stop being hearts and thumbs up, and it'll just be like, go fuck yourself or don't go fuck yourself. Those will be the two options of things you can click. Like, we won't even, I can't even believe we're still living in a society where we still hit like on things. Like, that seems too polite for where we've gotten to as a society. So anywho, how is your 4th of July? So I went to Massachusetts to, my mom had a wrist surgery on July 3rd. She's got some carpal tunnel in both hands. My sister and I tried to get her to do acupuncture. We did, and we even put CBD oil on her, or CBD cream on her a few months ago. we said, try this cream. It's really great. It's from the acupuncturist. It's for this stuff. She slept with it overnight. We're like, did it help me get a little bit? And I'm like, it's pot cream. I thought I felt a little something. I'm like, no, it's not psychoactive. You didn't get high. Because I think my mom is, you know, 80. Like, pot to her used to be like heroin. It was like, oh my God, people are smoking pot. I can't believe it. But there's always this story floating around. And I forgot to ask her. There was a pot brownie in her life. I believe she ate one by accident. I don't know if it was a whole one or a piece or I don't know. But she's one of those people where you're like, you know, you secretly want it in your life, but you're from that generation that still thinks it's like really bad and like you're trying to let go. And I see it happening in other areas where I'm like, you can yell at your doctor and say you don't know what you're fucking talking about. I mean, I'm not gonna yell at them, but like they're not your mommy, your daddy, your preacher, your God, your teacher. You know, this is a human. Anyway, so she was. It was just too intense of a pain, and they did some testing, and it truly was that. It wasn't coming from her back, which is what I thought. My recorder just crashed in the middle of recording, so who knows what I was saying. But anyway, I flew home. Now, did they need me to fly home? No, but there was a heat wave. My sister was working on the third. She's the one that lives in Massachusetts. My dad's also 80. It's like they don't do both wrists at once. One of her wrists was going to still be in pain. The other one will have just been surgically surgized. That's not a word. And so I went home to help out in case she needed help. Of course, see, my parents are from that generation where you don't ask for help. There's no help. And it's also just like a personality type. It's like, they're like, why would you come home? You just got back from New York and London, which I asked myself that question. I really wanted to spend an entire month in Los Angeles in June, and it did not happen. I had to go to London, and then I had to go to New York for work, and then, you know, whatever. I don't mean I had to, but I mean, I was like, look, it's in a week. You know how sometimes maybe you'll relate to this, maybe you won't. If you have a week free, it's sometimes easy. Like, you can just visit me when you're closer to home. I'm like, because, you know, I'm going to be living in New York this summer. I could take a train to Boston, but, you know, you're working until early Friday evening, and then do you want to run to Penn Station with a suitcase and then get on a train? And it's going to be, or you get to the airport, and it's actually weirdly more convenient to just drive to the airport at LAX, get on a plane, get off, get a car, go to your parents, and then repeat that 2 days later. Than to like be in New York. And I don't know what it is. Sometimes I find the weirdest things easier than things that probably are technically not easier. But but it's also the thing of like, look, the woman's 80, she's going under anesthesia. Let's not bullshit ourselves. I'm nervous to go under anesthesia at 43, you know, when I went under this year and I had to do all this pre-op and get a test and, you know, all this to make sure you're healthy for it. And, you know, once you're over 40, they got to start giving you a chest x-ray if you're going to get anesthesia. And, you know, we all know Joan Rivers died under anesthesia again because her doctor took a selfie, wasn't qualified to give anesthesia and did it wrong. And there was no way to revive her if it fucked up, and it did fuck up. And Michael Jackson died of anesthesia, but that's because he was bringing it home and his doctor left the room for a minute. I mean, if you're going to do anesthesia at home, you at least got to stay with the patient. You can't be like, oh, I'm going to quick take a phone call in the other room. Like, why do you have to take the phone call in the other room? If Michael Jackson is under anesthesia, I don't think he's eavesdropping. Like, oh, this conversation's private. Like, at what point you have decency to keep a conversation private, but you're like, yeah, I'll just risk this guy's life and bring him propofol tanks at home. That'll be good. I've got the right values. So anyway, but my mom had told me a few days before, I had a dream about Joan Rivers. And I said, don't come take me yet. Now, apparently Joan Rivers, who's a Jewish woman where there's no afterlife, will be somehow in the God position, if we're going to go all religious, and take my mom, which is she's the one greeting my mom in the heaven that her religion doesn't believe in. She could be greeting my mom. Not my mom's mom or my mom's dad or my mom's dead cat. Joan Rivers. That's what she's doing in her spare time in the afterlife, is going to greet the mother of a comedian she met a few times and vaguely knew. Okay. I said, Joan, don't come take me yet. So there was that sort of underneath it all, like, I'm coming home just in case something happens. I mean, you know that that's the deal when I get up and go to the hospital with them for the 6 a.m. check-in. You know, it's like, what's the point of flying in the night before in case something happens during the... And it was good that I was there because my dad can be a little out of it. And I just was being bossy. And I was like, when we went into the pre-op area, you know, they have all those curtains and you lay in your little bed and the nurse comes in and then the anesthesiologist comes in and they're hooking you up. I sat there and I asked 50 questions about what's going to happen after the surgery, what she needs to do and, you know, blah, blah, blah. I had to force my mother, you have to ice and you have to keep your arm elevated. So, yeah, so I sat there. I like hospitals, though. Like, I'm not always excited when I'm the guinea pig with all the things being stuck in me, but it's not the hospital's fault. But I always feel comfortable in hospitals because I'm like, if anything goes wrong, I'm in a hospital. That's where they deal with if anything goes wrong. And I don't even have to waste time getting here. We go, oh, I get nervous in hospitals. I go, but you're literally in the place that you would be taken to if something bad happened. So, you know what I mean? Like, if I'm driving my car or flying a helicopter and I have a heart attack, that's not a great place to be while doing that. But if I'm sitting in the hospital and I suddenly go into cardiac arrest, that's like the best place to go into it. So I don't know why people don't like hospitals. Maybe it reminds them of their mortality. See, I'm always thinking about it anyway, so it's like a comfort to me. They got all the fluids here. They got all the drugs here. They got all the people that can help. They got beds. My mother refused the warm blanket. We'll bring you a warm blanket. I don't need it. I get very hot. I go, I'll take it. I literally wasn't kidding, but they didn't bring me one. They go, we'll bring a blanket, just not a heated one. I don't need one. And what are you doing? Why are you laying under a sheet like some hero? Get a blanket. But she was too hot. I'm too hot. So I just, at this point, I just sit there and I videotape my parents and they just have like zero reaction. Like I have like a million little videos of them like interacting in the pre-op area. And, you know, my mother going, this is kind of like Auschwitz. I go, no, it's not like Auschwitz. Well, I don't mean that. It's just very impersonal. And I go, because that's what was Auschwitz was like. It was impersonal, I think is the, I know she meant she felt she basically got it down to, I feel like cattle being herded. And I get that. And then when you go, oh, okay, well, that's how people were herded into the, but let's just let when you're laying in a hospital bed, when you just refused a warm blanket and people are coming in and being nice to you and they gave you some socks with some grippy things on the bottom, like they didn't do that in Auschwitz. And I go, Mom, of course I'm videotaping her. Do not put this on the internet. So of course I put it on my podcast. My dad's sitting next to her. What did she say? Oh, geez, don't say it. This is like, you say the damnedest things. And she's like, I didn't mean it. I meant, I feel, okay, erase that. Take that pad out. Like I have this power to edit on my iPhone. Or maybe I do. I just don't know because I'm too old. I just meant, I feel like a herded cattle. But it's like these videos, they're not like stop taping me. Stop taping me as I freeform think at 7 a.m. It's just like, can you edit that? Can we get a filter here? Like, they're very showbiz now. They just accept that I, for some reason, videotape them a lot. I also just think it's nice to have keepsakes of your family, you know, against their will. So, yeah, so surgery went great. My dad and I went to have breakfast during the surgery. We went to the hospital coffee shop, which was actually very nice, very clean, very beautiful. But, you know, it's a hospital coffee shop. Like, it's not atmospheric by any means. But it wasn't gross. Cleaner than a diner would be. But again, no atmosphere. You know you're in a hospital. So we get this omelet. My dad's like, hey, John, how you doing? Talking to the guy making the omelet. And the guy has a name tag on, so I assume my dad's being that person. He's being very dad, and he's, you know, just acting like he knows. The guy's like, Ron, where you been? I'm like, wait, what? I'm like, this guy remembers you from your head surgery 3 years ago? Wait, no, he couldn't. That was a different hot. Wait, how do you know this guy? He's like, I come here for breakfast. I go, how often? He's like, oh, once a week. I'm like, what? I go, why are you coming here for breakfast? He goes, to bother Dawn. I'm like, no, you. My dad like never answers anything. I'm like, no, I'm serious. Why do you eat breakfast at a hospital diner? When, like, go to a diner. He's like, where's there diners anymore? I'm like, okay. He goes, I go with my friend Bill from work. I'm like, who's Bill? This is all secret life my dad has, where some mornings he goes with his friend Bill, whom I've never heard of to this day. I know you're like, your dad works at 80. My dad was a greenskeeper for this golf course, and he still kind of pokes. So he's officially retired, but he has affairs in all the different areas of the golf club. Like he might oversee a thing or two or whatever, but he's got, you know, one of his friends from there. And I'm like, what? So I guess he just has this, I mean, ask your parents, do you have a secret life? And you might find out some things. I didn't even have to ask. He goes and gets breakfast once a month. I mean, once a week or once a month. I don't know how often, but I couldn't even get that out of him. I was like, that's the weirdest, it's just the weirdest thing ever to me. And of course, the guy was like, who's this young lady? And I'm like, I'm his daughter. He's like, oh, I thought, you know, you old perv. Like that's like when you meet an old man, he's just like, I'm just going to talk about sex to your face. Because that's the generation I'm from, where, like, I have to make a joke that I'm glad you're not your dad's girlfriend, which makes me want to vomit. And I'm like, nope, but thanks for just sullying this entire experience where you could just have treated me like a human. But it's always like, woman, woman. It's like cartoon where they see a piece of meat, like, woman. Like, that's, I'm sorry to the men listening. My mother did it to me. She goes, you know, they say it's not all men. I was thinking, no, it is. It's all men. Oh, will you turn up Jeopardy? Like, she just has these, you know, it's just like definitive. Like, no, no, it is. Anyway, I don't like that Alex Trebek. He really thinks he's better than other people. And you know what? She might be right. I don't know. They told him the show was going too long, and he said, well, he's not going to stop explaining things. I don't know what the source of that is. I don't even know. I just take it at face value and go, oh, okay. But I'm going to look that up. Did they tell Alex Trebek? Because the shows are going too long, because that's not a thing. They're not going to air a show that's too long. So they're probably doing a lot of editing. Alex Trebek, show's going too long. I'm going to Google this. My internet's not working. Does Alex Trebek waste too much time on Jeopardy? Okay. This is from the website Quora, which isn't like a news website. And somebody wrote, does Alex Trebek waste too much time on Jeopardy? And then there's an answer, as though there's a different. The show is edited and has many gaps in it due to technical errors, on-set noise, comfort breaks, and miscellaneous issues. If Trebek did not attempt to smooth over these gaps, they would be far more noticeable than they are in a normal production. Additionally, many of the contestants on Jeopardy, and I hate to say this because I love the show, are not the most interesting people out there. If Alex Trebek didn't interject some of his comments into the show, it would quickly grow dull for all but the most ardent of fans, and the ratings would drop as a result. I would advise the questioner to watch several episodes carefully. You'll be able to see where things went wrong, and either Trebek steps to smooth them out with additional dialogue, or the editing is more noticeable than it normally is. Oh, that's a good point. So I don't know what my mother's talking about. There was some news article about he talks too much. I know he took, he had brain surgery this year. I don't know. She's angry at him. But it is amazing, there was this one question and the answer was William Tell, like the book William Tell. And, the guy who got the answer correct, he said, so William Tell is a folk hero of Switzerland, right? So it's, the book is called The Legend of William Tell. So the question was blah, 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 blah. And the answer was, who is William Tell? Well, since it was a Swedish person, I think he was giving the like actual original title. He's like, who is Wilhelm Tell? And Alex is like, no, I'm sorry. This Canadian accent. And the next guy, beep, beep, beep. who is William Tell, and the man next to him that said, who is Wilhelm Tell, that knows he's right because he's doing the, you know, original pronunciation, just sits there stone-faced, and Oxenberg goes, yes, William Tell, that's correct, and that guy gets the money. And that guy that goes, Wilhelm Tell, he doesn't go, motherfucker, same thing. He doesn't do that. He just stands there stone-faced. Zero reaction. I don't know if they just manage to get people that have no reactions to things in life or if they tell them, do not react. So then we come back from a commercial, and Alex Trebek is like, I have a correction. The judges have decided that Wilhelm Tell is correct. And so, sorry, dude that said William Tell, we're now taking your money away and we're giving it to Wilhelm Tell. And Wilhelm Tell guy doesn't even go, that's right, motherfucker, I told you that shit. He doesn't go, ooh, ooh. He doesn't do the I'm right dance. He does nothing. And the other guy doesn't go, oh, fucking fuck you. Nobody says Wilhelm Tell. Like, there's none of that. I would just like to see just one moment of someone losing their shit, and I might tune in more. I was getting nothing correct. I was just yelling out. I think a fun thing to do would be to, like, walk by someone's house as they're watching Jeopardy and just hear them yell out weird things like, the Star Spangled Banner! Pirates! The War of 1812! She's like, that's the weirdest argument someone's having in the house. They're bringing up a lot of points. I can't hear the other side. Anyway, so that's what I did. And I guess I didn't tell you guys about my London trip. That's on tap for this episode. But I think that I have to wait until I'm able to announce one of the goings-on the London trip. I know you're in such suspense, you can't deal with it. I know one thing that went on my London trip is I checked my luggage because I like to bring full-size products when I travel. I bring my full-size products when I travel. And my newest full-size product that I'm using is my Suave shampoo. I used to be a shampoo snob. You know, like, oh, I'm going to use, going to be $400. I'm telling you, Suave's killing it. Now, they have a bunch of new, I won't say new. They didn't tell me to say it's new, but I'm going to call it new. It's new to me. And the one that I'm using is called Damage Repair. Suave Coconut Oil Infusion. And then you're like, Jen, your hair's not damaged. Oh, it is, honey, but you can't tell. You can't tell because it's shiny and smooth and it looks really healthy. But I bleach the tips of my hair. I don't really know why I've been doing that for so long. It's just fun for me. I like to put my hair in a ponytail and have the ponytail be different color than my bangs. It's my little thrill. But yeah, I mean, so, and then on top of it, I blow it dry and then I use a hair curling iron. And it's 'cause I'm from the 1940s, a hair curling iron. And, all of that is very damaging to the hair. So I can't mess around with shampoo and just use some crap because you have to keep your hair strong. And also it looks really shiny and healthy, but that's also because it is. So I use Damage Repair, Suave Coconut Oil Infusion. And I started with the shampoo and conditioner. I started using it about a month now. It makes my hair super healthy and shiny. It actually works. You don't have to take my word for it, but they do have a money back guarantee. Try it for yourself. Suave for hair you can believe. Now I wish that's the ad. Like, they want me to tell my experience and to tell you guys that there's a money back guarantee, but it's not like you can go to the website and say, hey, I listen to Jen Kirkman's podcast. So if you're buying it, if you bought any of the new Suave shampoos, send me a tweet at I Seem Fun Podcast, just for me. I'd like to know, and tell me, and I'll read it on air in another commercial. How does that sound? That is fun. All right, I'm going to do something fun that I like to do when I need inspo for topics. Oh, there was an article I was going to read, though. Beep, 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 beep. There was an article I was going to read. Oh, I wanted to read this article, and I as long as I talked about this like Nazi movie, it's not the same, but it's like true stories that I've kind of love. So this is from the Washington Post. This was from April, but it's a new documentary that's coming out. I don't know, maybe it's out now, but it's called Why You've Never Heard of the Six Chinese Men Who Survived the Titanic. Okay, so in the early hours of April 15th, 1912, a lifeboat navigated the frigid waters of the North Atlantic. Did I tell you guys my Leonardo DiCaprio story when Titanic came out? Did I tell you this? Let me just tell you this story first. I see Titanic. I hadn't seen a movie in the theaters in years. I had a lot of anxiety disorders like right when in the years that Titanic came out, like in the 90s. When I graduated high school and went to college, like my anxiety disorders were getting pretty bad. And I had panic attacks, like all kinds of different places. And I saw Dazed and Confused in the theater like six times. Not sure why. I just like was obsessed with that movie. And then like I didn't see another movie again until Titanic. I don't in the theaters. I'm not sure why. I would just get anxiety in like certain, or I'd go to like a little theater. But like a big one freaked me out. I was all like that kind of agoraphobia that's tied in with panic disorder. Blah, la, 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 la. So my roommates and I, they were like, let's go to the big Cineplex and see, how old am I? Let's go to the Cineplex and see Titanic. And I'm like, oh, I don't know. I'm going to get like anxious and it's about a boat sinking. And then I don't know, I'm a panic. And I fell in love with it. I fell hook, line, and sinker for the fucking movie to the point where I'm so dumb. I'm like, was that true? I mean, I knew it wasn't like true, but I was like, I wonder if there was like an inter-class romance on the Titanic, but that'll never be known, I suppose. But there were six Chinese men. So anyway, so I see the movie. Now, I'm not one of these people that falls in love with Leo. I remembered him from Growing Pains and Gilbert Grape, and to me, he was always like a little boy. But I loved the romance in the movie. This was a crazy year. I went to a Saturday Night Live after party that year. I was living in Boston. It was a whole thing. This story is infamous. I went as Ben Stiller's guest. He is not in my life. He was for 6 hours. I go to the party, and it's like tons of celebrities are there. Leonardo DiCaprio is just wandering around. When you're in a room, and it's like 2 a.m, and there's all these celebrities, and you're a little drunk, it's very weird when you see a celebrity of that caliber, because you don't realize how often, it's not just that you saw him in the movie that time, like his face is everywhere, you know, it's like billboards and commercials, and he's just, that face has always been a part of your life since you were a little kid watching Growing Pains. You don't react right away sometimes, or I don't, but I've seen this happen, even in my small celebrity, which is 0.000001. People go, you look so familiar. Did I go to high school with you? And I'm like, nope. And then I always go, well, I was on Chelsea Lately and Drunk History and Emily. I don't watch TV. I go, oh, okay. Well then, you know, it makes me crazy. Anyway, so I literally had never experienced this before. I'd never been in a room with that many celebrities. I'd never even seen an A-lister, I don't think. And I'd met Jane Curtin when I was 12. She was very rude to me. My mom and I like went to an event in Boston that was not even about comedy, but she was speaking about something else, but we're like, let's wait around after. And I was like, hey, I want to be in, I think I said comedy. Like I did know I wanted to do comedy when I was a kid, but then also I didn't, like it, you know, it changed around a lot. And I was like, and you're my favorite. I loved you on SNL. And I had an autograph book. Like we came in from the suburbs. I go, will you sign it? She goes, nope, never sign them. I can still see your face. Nope, never, with her little inverted mouth. Nope, never sign him. And she had these red gloves on. Nope, never sign him. And I was just like, okay. And she walked away. My mom was like, that's not very nice, Jane. You're not a good person. It really sullied Kate and Allie for me. I'm not going to fucking lie to you people. Anyway, so I'm at the party. I see Leo DiCaps. And I'm like, is that my friend Mike from high school? He looked like my friend Mike, because I've also never seen a celebrity dressed down. So he had his bangs in front of his face. He was wearing all black. And it was a Saturday Night Live after party. And I remember my friend Mike from high school was on the theater crew in the musical, Anything Goes. I played Bonnie. No big deal. What was that song, Heaven Hop? Spread your wings and start them flapping. Nee, nee, nee. And do the heaven hop. Hop the heaven hop. Yeah. Wag your ankles to that nee, nee. Dun, dun. Let your shoulders gently. If you want to, please, St. Peter. Because I had to play like a gangster's wife who was dumb, so I sang it with a little accent and kind of sang off key. When the angels play low on their harps of gold, kneel and blenna, then get up and shake your halo with beepa. I was great, kids. I was great. Anyway, Mike was the backstage guy who had to wear all black. He always had his bangs in his face. He always had like walking around with his, you know, combat boots on, moving the sets around. You run backstage real quick. Hey, Mike. Yeah. And you get back out there. And I was like, oh, this is my friend Mike. Like, Mike and I weren't even close. Like, I saw him literally backstage, and then, like, I never saw him in classes or school. It was just like, I don't even know what grade he was in. But I was like, that's that tech hand Mike. Because that's how far away, like, Mike's face has always been in my life all through the years at school. Just like Leo's face in the last 10 years. It always been in my life, whether it was growing pains or this or that. And I went right up to him and I was like, oh my God, Mike must have gotten a job on Saturday Night Live, like working as the backstage crew. And I was like, Mike. And he goes, don't do that. A lot of people pretend they think I'm someone else so they can start talking to me. He's like, you know who I am. Or like, basically, I'm not getting it word for word, but it was around that. And I was like, huh? And I thought it was like Mike joking with me. Like, it's still, and then I was like, oh, and I realized who I was talking to. And I was like, oh God, I was so embarrassed. And I just walked, like ran away. Anyway, so that's my Titanic story. Actually, it's not a Titanic story, is it? Anyway, so this article, the six Chinese men. In the early hours of April 15th, 1912, a lifeboat navigated the frigid waters of the North Atlantic Ocean. Its skeleton crew, first of all, I'm having an ADD attack. Would you please forgive me? But I do think of things like, how bad did the Titanic smell? Like, did people have bad breath? Like, there weren't showers. Like, were people just not, do you know what I mean? I think about that stuff. And when I think about that stuff, I think about how awesome my Quip toothbrush is. And I just packed and I'm taking my Quip with me. Well, why would I use a different toothbrush for 2 months somewhere else? I don't know. People do weird shit when they travel. They become different people, but not me. I like things in my life that can remain a constant. So here's something to chew on. Many recent studies suggest that having good oral health impacts your overall health. That is true. Off the top of my head, I know it's good for your heart to have good gums. But you don't need a big expensive toothbrush to get the oral care you need. Get the same refreshing clean with something simpler that'll give you the best brushing experience you've ever had. Your mouth is really important. Your teeth, how your breath smells. This all impacts people's impression of you. Introducing Quip, Q-U-I-P, the new company that's refreshing the way people brush their teeth. It's an electric toothbrush that packs premium vibration and timer features into an ultra-slim design. It's half the cost of bulkier brushes, and it's half the size. So I have a cute one. It's like rose gold, and it comes with a little sticky thing. You can hang it on your mirror, and it also acts as a cover. And what they mean by vibrations is you put it in your mouth, you brush your teeth, and then it vibrates when it's time to move to the next quadrant. So you do the four quadrants of your mouth, and it's basically, it's like someone telling you how to brush your teeth. You can subscribe to it. This is the best part. So you get new brush heads on a dentist-recommended three-month plan for just $5, including free shipping. So here's what you're going to do. Go to getquip.com/fun right now, getquip.com/fun, and you're going to get your first refill pack free with a Quip electric toothbrush. That's your first refill pack free at getquip.com/fun. It's backed by leading dentists, was named as one of Time Magazine's best inventions of 2016, made it on Oprah's 2017 New Year's O list. It's an electric toothbrush. Price point starts at $25, since the prices vary based on the handle and the plan selection. 75% of us don't refresh our bristles or visit the dentist on time, and that's why you need Quip. That's what I love about it, is it shows up in the mail, and I'm like, oh my God, 3 months has gone by? It's a really kind of cool way to watch time pass. But it's a thoughtful, inexpensive solution for people who want to make it easy to keep up with simple habits. It's been called the Apple and Tesla of toothbrushes. GetQuip.com, GetQuip.com/fun. Get on it. Be like me. Have cute, fun things in your bathroom. Life's too short to have some janky-ass toothbrush. Okay, anyway. Titanic. I promised to read the whole article. In the early hours of April 15th, 1912, a lifeboat navigated the frigid waters of the North Atlantic Ocean, its skeleton crew scanning the dark, debris-littered surface for any sign of life. Hours earlier, the unthinkable had happened. The RMS Titanic, you never hear the RMS part, that was deemed unsinkable had struck an iceberg and slowly disappeared into the sea. Hundreds of passengers fled in lifeboats. Hundreds more perished, going down with the ship or freezing to death in the icy water. The only one of Titanic's lifeboats to turn back to the wreckage found body after body until it discovered a young Chinese man still alive clinging to a piece of wood. That man would be one of six Chinese passengers who survived the Titanic. A little known fact about the historic disaster that has been largely untold or distorted owing to a racially hostile environment toward Chinese people in the West at the turn of the 20th century. But now the lives of these men, who they were, how they survived that night, and why they were barred from entering the United States is being examined in a new documentary called The Six. So there was something like 700 Titanic survivors. They've all been claimed, if all the claims are to be believed, Jones, a Shanghai-based filmmaker, told the Washington Post. These were the only guys amongst those 700 that no one ever claimed. They just completely disappeared. Why did they get ignored? On April 10th, the Titanic set off under her maiden voyage to the United States from Southampton, England. The ship was supposed to arrive a week later at its destination, New York City. Instead, 11:30 p.m. on April 14th, the Titanic struck an iceberg off the coast of Newfoundland and began to take on water. It was swallowed by the frigid waters of what is now known as Iceberg Alley. About 1,500 people died. About 700 passengers survived. They were plucked from their lifeboats by the RMS Carpathia the next morning. Blah, blah, blah. Over the past century, volumes have been written about hundreds of the Titanic survivors and victims, their life stories preserved in astonishing detail by history books and their descendants. However, for six Chinese passengers who survived the sinking, their ties to the Titanic have all but vanished. The New Jersey native, who has lived in China for 22 years, has recently observed, recently researched the Titanic and come across a brief mention of these six survivors. But the more he tried to find out about the six, the more dead ends he hit. It really started to bother me. Like, why don't we know? Like any history project, you start pulling the threads and it just seemed like the thread didn't lead anywhere. Before long, he had persuaded Jones to abandon their original film project and launch the six. With little to go on first but the passenger manifest and list of survivors, the team set up a simple website, whoarethesix.com, to crowdsource tips. The invisibility of the six Chinese survivors is such that even in China, Jones and Schwenker, this guy that's making the movie as well, find themselves telling people, yes, there were, in fact, Chinese passengers on the Titanic. Eight Chinese nationals boarded the ship at Southampton, to be exact. Their names appear in rigid cursive on a single ticket for third-class passengers. Ah Lam, Fang Lang, Len Lam, Chung Fu, Chang Chip, Ling He, Li Bing, and Li Ling. Through 2 years of painstaking documentation, the filmmakers determined that the men in the group probably knew one another beforehand, having worked together as professional sailors on various ships in Britain. Because of an ongoing coal strike there, the men were being transferred by their company to a freighter docked in New York, the Aneta, which was going to take them to Cuba. The reason they were traveling on Titanic in the first place was for work. They were professional mariners, and they were being seconded from their company in the UK to go work on the companies in North America. The trip did not go as planned. How the eight men responded as the Titanic began taking on water may never be known. They would have been traveling in steerage, the lowest class of cabins, where the survival rate for non-British men was only about 20%. What was documented is that one of the Chinese men was later found clinging to a large piece of floating wood by the one main lifeboat that chose to return to the wreckage to search for signs of life. Five others escaped in lifeboats. Notably, four were in Collapsible C, a backup escape vessel with canvas siding that was one of the last lifeboats to be lowered from the ship. They happened to share the same lifeboat as Joseph Bruce Ismay, the chairman of the White Star Line, which owned the Titanic. Ismay, who was later pilloried for saving himself instead of going down with the ship, despite being such a high-ranking official, testified in official inquiries that, quote, four Chinamen were in the boat in which he had escaped. The ship's quartermaster was on Collapsible C as well and also testified to the presence of the Chinese passengers, though he suggested they had found the four men between the seats at daybreak. The man who made the movie said, let me put it this way. I view the Chinese passengers as the Rosencrantz and Guildenstern of the Titanic. They're not major characters, but they pop up at really opportune moments in the story. In the beginning, Ismay's testimony was really some of the only information that we had that even verified that they existed. So even after the Carpathia arrived in New York on April 18th, the troubles for the six Chinese men were not over. Because of the Chinese Exclusion Act passed in 1882, the group of survivors was not permitted to enter the United States. They instead were forced to board the Aneta, their intended ship of transfer, and the next day departed the country, bound for fruit ships in the Caribbean. They were always going to be banned from entering the country because they were always meant to transfer to the Aneta and move on down south. But however, the filmmaker points out that other survivors were allowed to bypass screening at Ellis Island, or they received medical aid because of the trauma they had just experienced. The Chinese men were not. Do we call it deportation, or do we just say they were in transit? I think if we call it in transit, we miss that they were not treated humanely. We know they lost close friends on board, and yet they weren't given the option of staying. Not only did they have to leave in 24 hours on board the Aneta, they were held overnight in custody. They were detained. Both agree that the attitude toward Chinese and other Asian minorities then was hostile, as evidenced in the tone of the few newspaper articles that mentioned them at the time. For instance, in an unsourced April 19, 1912 Brooklyn Daily Eagle article headlined Heroism of Anglo-Saxon Sailors Stands Out in Disaster, the Chinese passengers are described as almost inhuman and regarded with the utmost suspicion. Quote, the one dark spot is the fact that in the bottom of one lifeboat which left the Titanic were found wedged beneath the seats the bodies of two dead Chinese coolies and eight living ones, the article stated. They were creatures on their way to New York to join a sailing ship for the Orient and who, at the first sign of danger, had sprung into the lifeboats. They were trampled upon by the women who were lowered into the boats later and two of them crushed to death. The questionable passenger count notwithstanding, Schwenkert says there's no evidence that the men stowed away or took the place of women and children on Collapsible C, which was not filled when it was discovered. In fact, the documentary team efforts include building a life-size replica of Collapsible C to prove that it would have been impossible for four men to hide at all, let alone overnight. The other news articles that you read about the Chinese men, there is this sense that they were somehow not entitled to seats on lifeboats. Ismay was called a coward, or certainly painted as a coward, for not going down with the ship and for taking a place in the lifeboat. But there was another first-class gentleman in Collapsible Lifeboat C. He gets in the boat, and he basically gets off scot-free. No one ever criticizes him for surviving. It took more than two years for these guys to fact-check every detail they can find about the lives of the six survivors. The research and interviews have taken them to London, Liverpool, United States, Cuba, Caribbean, Canada, back to China. Against the odds, they've been able to track down several descendants of the six men, many of whom have never connected their relatives to the historic disaster. Cameron, to his credit, filmed a scene in Titanic in which a Chinese man is rescued from a wooden plank in the water. It was later deleted, though the clip can be found in the director's cut and on YouTube. The sixth documentary is in production and is to be released this year or next. The most important thing, says the filmmaker, is that they're given their rightful place in history, and he hopes to prove that they were not cowards and they didn't live at the expense of others who didn't survive. I just thought that was so fascinating, especially with everything that's going on in the country now and how we talk about people who are other as though they aren't human and as though they don't deserve the same things that everybody deserves. So I will look forward to that documentary. I think it's fascinating. I don't know how people survive such things. I really need a lot of help with my life, and I'm glad that I am in therapy, and I encourage all of you. I want every I Seem Fun listener to get into therapy, or else you can't listen anymore. How does that sound? Everybody, it's too late. You didn't get your beach body, did you? Why don't you get your beach brain? Okay, you said you were going to diet. January 1st, I'm going to diet. I'm going to get my beach body. Well, now it's July 7th, and you can't fit into your bathing suit, and your legs are like sausages in your little swim trunks. You're like, damn it, I can't fit into my bathing suit. No shame, but you said you wanted to. So how about this? The holidays are coming up in 6 months. You go, what the hell does that have to do with anything? Well, I'm telling you, you can't just, not eat for 2 days and think you're going to fit into your swim trunks in 2 days. Not going to happen. And you don't think, if you don't start taking care of your mental health now, who knows what kind of shape you're going to be in for the holiday season. So think about it that way. I always say, you get your beach body in the summer. In the winter, you can work on your beach body for the summer. And in the summer, you can work on your holiday brain for the winter. Why not get a head start? I know you go, oh, it's too expensive. I can't go to therapy. Oh, I don't want to leave the office for my lunch hour. Everyone's going to judge me. They're going to know where I'm going. Well, that's why I love my favorite sponsor, Talkspace. Go to Talkspace.com/Jen, J-E-N, and you can read all about how awesome Talkspace is. But it is the online therapy company that enables you to get matched with a licensed therapist. These are people with their master's degrees and more from over 2,000 choices of people, and message them whenever you need to. You don't have to commute. There's no judgments. For our listeners, if you use code Jen, you will get $45 off of your first month. That's crazy. Talkspace, TalkSpace.com/Jen, G-E-N. Use code Jen to get $45 off your first month. Again, it is a fraction of the price of traditional therapy. And again, you don't have to be like, oh my God, I'm traumatized. I was on the Titanic and I was forgotten. It's just, you can get everyday life skills from somebody who's trained to listen to you, unlike your dumb friend that you vent to at lunch. I mean, you can dig into childhood memories if you want, but it's also practical everyday strategies for stress management, living a happier life. Having a therapist simply provides you a designated person for you to talk to. What I love about Talkspace is, like, unlike, you know, a therapist that you see once a week in person, like, you can message them from anywhere, anytime. All you need is a computer with the internet connection or the Talkspace mobile app. So it's amazing. It's probably the best use of the internet that I can think that we've had. So Talkspace.com/Jen, $45 off if you use code Jen at checkout. And why wouldn't you? Wouldn't you want to waste money? I don't think so. If you do, get your head checked at Talkspace.com. Oh my God. What else can I tell you, people? What else can I tell you, folks? Okay, so let's read some fun emails. Oh, well, this is speaking of therapy. Hey, Jen, I'm 40 and suffer from depression and anxiety. Appreciate the fact that you don't shy away from talking about those things on the podcast. Blah, blah, blah. The other is they talk about the teleferry sensor. The other thing I'm going to talk about, because I think it's really relevant, is the new research being done with psychedelics. I was desperate to find some relief from my anxiety and depression, which, as you know, can just be debilitating in a way that people who don't suffer from them just don't seem to understand. I'd tried several medications, which made me actually a pretty terrible human. Therapy helps to a degree, but I was still having trouble managing on certain days. So my husband did some research, and we decided that I should try psilocybin. This was not something we entered into lightly. We are pretty straight-laced, somewhat nerdy people. We ordered a spore kit and a grow setup, both of which are legal, and set about growing mushrooms. They only become illegal once they're in the mushroom stage. Interesting. That's a weird thing, like, grow your own drugs. Like, it's not illegal till they become drugs, but that's interesting. Now, let's see. Cary Grant using... I know you're like, what are you... Okay, so I'll get to that in a minute. I have now had two psilocybin journeys, carefully curating the set and setting, a quiet afternoon at home with my husband as guide. Let me tell you, I feel like my life has changed a lot. My anxiety is all but gone, and I don't feel the crushing weight of depression anymore. I also feel more empathy and compassion, and I feel pretty good about who I am as a person. And recently, Michael Pollan, who has written some notable books like The Omnivore's Dilemma, which that book I have, released his new book, How to Change Your Mind, where he chronicles his own experience with psychedelics and also discusses the different studies being done that utilize psilocybin and other psychedelics to treat patients in palliative care, end-of-life existential dread, depression, anxiety, and addiction. The results have been pretty amazing. Basically, I just wanted to recommend that book to you, How to Change Your Mind. Not necessarily because I think you should try psilocybin as a form of therapy. It strikes me as something you might find interesting. I totally find it interesting. Now, I don't think that kind of tripping would be good for my anxiety because mine is specific about losing control in that specific way. And I don't mean that you didn't know this, but like the sense of empathy and stuff, like I do a lot of outside kind of spiritual stuff that really helps me with that. But I do have end of life anxiety, and I'm open to, as I'm older, and if I knew I was definitely in the end of my life, like if I was diagnosed with like a stage billion cancer, I'd probably do it. Just for me right now, I don't feel I need to. But I'm fascinated with it too. And actually, if you guys want to check out a great podcast, My pal and wonderful person, Michael Ian Black, has a podcast called How to Be Amazing. And on a recent episode, he interviewed Michael Pollan, and Michael talked about that and about, you know, in a therapist setting and in a very, you know, make sure everything's okay setting, like people are using, for lack of a better word, like psychedelics to deal with some of that stuff. But there was a great article years ago. I think it was originally in Vanity Fair, but I just Googled it now. It's on theguardian.com. Cary Grant did 100 acid trips and it changed his life. He, at the height of his fame, Cary Grant turned to LSD therapy for help. He later claimed the drug saved him, but it did also spell the end of his career. In the late 50s, at the height of his fame, so a lot of housewives in Beverly Hills, too, were doing, I don't know if it was psilocybin, but they were doing, like, taking acid under the care of a therapist to go back into, like, trauma. It's like a safe way to travel through trauma, you know, blah, blah, blah. Of course, like, I don't recommend everyone listening, like, I'm in a tab of acid, dude. Like, I think it's a really sensitive topic, and I do not recommend it for anyone unless they talk to, you know, a specialist about this. But in the late 50s, the height of his fame, Cary Grant set off on a trip in search of his true self, unpicking the myth he had spent 3 decades perfecting. He tried hypnosis and yoga, felt they both came up short. So he began dropping acid and claimed to have found inner peace. During my LSD sessions, I would learn a great deal, he would later remark, and the result was a rebirth. I finally got where I wanted to go. Grant's adventures in psychedelia, an estimated 100 sessions spanning the years 1958 to 1961, provide the basis for Becoming Cary Grant, a fascinating documentary that plays at next week's Cannes Film Festival. Oh, I never saw that. Oh, I'm going to have to watch that documentary. Like all documentary makers, we start out looking at the construction of Cary Grant, says producer Nick Ware, but we ended up deconstructing him through the LSD sessions. Grant spent his life as a creature in flight. His mercurial nature was the making of him, a peculiarly Gatsby-esque urge that allowed a Bristol Street urchin named Archie Leach to reimagine himself as an American prince, the embodiment of Hollywood grace and glamour. Even so, the documentary does a good job in showing what spurred him, what spooked him, and how, wittingly or not, he dragged his former identity along for the ride. I have spent the greater part of my life fluctuating between Archie Leach and Cary Grant, unsure of each, suspecting each. The film opens a window onto a lost utopia of LSD therapy. Indirectly, it spotlights a school of experimental medicine that flourished briefly before the arrival of Timothy Leary in the West Coast hippie scene. Yeah, see, all those fucks ruined it. Between 1950 and 65, around 40,000 patients were prescribed lysergic acid to treat conditions as diverse as alcoholism, schizophrenia, and PTSD. In the UK, Powick Hospital founded an LSD clinic. In the U.S., the CIA tested the drug as a truth serum. Turned on to the treatment by his third wife, Betsy Drake, right, that's what I had read, Grant submitted himself to weekly sessions with Dr. Mortimer Hartman at the Psychiatric Institute of Beverly Hills. This is it. The effects were startling. In one LSD dream, I imagined myself as a giant penis launching off from Earth like a spaceship. And I won't go into the rest of the article, but you know what? That's what it all comes down to, doesn't it? I was healed. It's always about, does it always have to come back to your penis? I don't think it's some men. I think it's all. Oh, God. Well, listen, stay safe out there. Watch documentaries. Learn about history. Be inspired by people who got more cojones than you. Stay off the LSD if it doesn't work for you. Get on it if it does. Who knows? I don't know what's right for anybody. Until next week, have fun.